Timeless presents Making It Work in the Workplace. This talk explores the system-wide changes that are needed to support working mothers and current innovations having an impact in the workplace. Despite some social changes, combining work and motherhood is still a challenge for contemporary women. Apple and Facebook have responded by offering egg freezing in women's benefits packages. But what other options are there for innovation in the workplace? What's failing about current systems, and who's doing anything to improve the status quo for women? With panelists Anne Phillips, professor of political and gender theory at the London School of Economics and Political Science, Nikki Sprints, co-founder of Ada's List, and Catherine Navrotsky, gender equality director at Business in the Community. The panel is chaired by journalist Yvonne Roberts. Timeless presents Making It Work in the Workplace.
We're not so much salesmen here for egg freezing, I hope. We're actually advocates for real social change. And I know I'm not supposed to be as, subjective, but that's my position. And it was very interesting because I don't know if you saw, but at the beginning of the week, there was a report from the Resolution Foundation actually saying that we have a massive problem of underemployment. So people who want to work more hours can't. And a massive problem of people being overqualified for the crappy jobs they do. So common sense tells you that that combination, plus an economic argument that is really well known, that you do better if you actually employ the kind of people that reflects the market you're trying to reach, beggars belief why there hasn't been more change in the workplace sooner. And the other thing I did this morning was to go on to the Creative Health website. And I think it is absolutely scandalous the way that these egg freezing companies have actually stolen the vocabulary of feminism. It's happened over the decades again and again. It used to be cigarettes, and then it was perfume. Now it's eggs, which actually tells you that you're going to successfully protect your fertility successfully with fast egg freezing. You do not protect your fertility. It talks about empowering women. You do not. You disempower women because you take away their collective muscle. And it also says this is a milestone on the road to gender equality, which is absolute bollocks. The other thing it says is, which is really extraordinary, and this is the most malevolent part, I think, and I'm sure some of the panel will go into this, the most malevolent part of the message that's being pushed out all the time. It says, delay motherhood until you have your life in order. I have two daughters, 31 and 21. I'm in the end of motherhood, maybe, or three quarters of the way through. My life is still chaos. I mean, it doesn't all start and finish. You know, having a baby is one thing. Actually doing the rest of your life is something completely different. And until the workplace changes, that will continue to be a real challenge. So I think we've got a multiplicity of things to talk about. We've got, is this the right way forward? Is it a new kind of employer perk? The rights of children is very important. That actually has got sort of dropped off the agenda. Are women too obsessed with control, that we always have to have control, even planning ahead for things that basically are anarchic? I mean, I don't know how many of you here have children already? One. Okay, so this is really future planned. Two. Okay. Right. Well, I won't say any more in case I put you off. But anyway, this is future planning. So I'm not going to say any more, but I am going to start. We'll start this end. So we'll start with Catherine. 5 minutes each, and then we'll go over to the audience.
Okay. Hello, everybody. I'm Catherine Navrotsky. I'm the Director of Gender Equality at Business in the Community. We work with employers trying to make workplaces better for women and for men, but coming from a stance of women's equality. And we have been going at it for 25 years. So this year we celebrate our 25th anniversary of campaigning on gender equality in the workplace, which in some ways feels like an amazing achievement and in other ways feels entirely depressing that there is still a need for us. But we work with employers across a range of industries and sectors, so around 200 organisations in the UK, to accelerate change for women at work. And we do that by working with business leaders to advance structural change in the workplace. So recognising that the way this discourse is often positioned in the public is very much about fixing the women. Women lack the confidence, women lack ambition, and so on and so forth. And I, as a woman who considers herself pretty confident, am quite tired of listening to that rhetoric, and I know plenty of women who feel the same. And if ever women do lack any sort of confidence or self-belief, it's probably well earned when they are operating in a system that systematically beats them down. But we focus very much on that structural change in the workplace, and so working with organisations to look at workplace cultures, to look at the processes and systems that they have created over time that ultimately are holding women back. And I was invited here today, I think, because of some of the research that we've done with women at work, who are all very much in this demographic, actually, that we're probably talking about here today. And so a couple of years ago, we started on a project called Project 28 to 40 that was all about women's experiences at work. Now, I have to say, we published just after the whole kind of Apple, Facebook, egg freezing policy came into the press, and so this wasn't something that figured in our question set, but maybe next time. But it does go to the heart of what women are really still experiencing in the workplace and why they think we don't have gender equality at work. This piece of research was overwhelming in terms of the response that we got. So we had 25,000 responses. 23,000 were from women, 2,000 were from men as well, so we were able to get a good control group of male responses. And they really told us in great detail, actually, in great personal detail, about their experiences of being in work. And overwhelmingly, the women that responded to that research tell us that they are confident, that they are ambitious, that they are really looking to progress their careers and to get ahead. Which tells us that when we're working with employers, tells us we have this fantastic talent pool already in the workforce and probably beyond. So what we're not doing is progressing them through, and that is absolutely because of those structural barriers. And women talked very openly and very honestly about the challenges that they're still facing in work today, whether that be around the challenges of flexible working and agile working, whether or not you have a family. Actually, for a lot of the women that responded, this wasn't even about having children, but about the way their employers manage those processes and policies. There were some deeply concerning findings about women's experiences of workplace cultures. So women are far more likely, first of all, to perceive that the culture of their organisation is male-dominated. They're far less likely to be confident in their employers around issues like equal pay. And yet, if we still have a majority of men predominating in senior leadership that is responsible for making all of those decisions and defining those cultures, things are really not going to change fast enough. And where it got really concerning is when we talked to women about their experiences of bullying and harassment still happening at work, and sexual harassment still happening at work. So over half of the female respondents to that research said they'd experienced some form of bullying and harassment at work in the past 3 years, which is so deeply concerning. And actually, it gets worse if we look at it by certain sectors. I think tech figures are quite highly up there, suitably. But also if we disaggregate for women's diversity as well. So if we look at different groups of women, so black women, gay women, bisexual women, disabled women, are far more likely to experience bullying and sexual harassment in the workforce, which is unacceptable. And it cannot always be women fighting for this change in the workforce. It has to be about leaders creating that structural change and looking at what they need to do to change those systems. And yet, interestingly, men and women aren't that different in what they expect out of their career development. You know, when we talked to them about what had helped them to get ahead, it wasn't all of these jazzy initiatives. I mean, you know, like I said, we weren't asking about egg freezing, but maybe we should put that on the list next time we run the survey. You know, it was actually just about good line management and good career development, things that help both men and women in equal measure, but yet so often seem to be biased and weighted towards the male perspective. And so since that, we've had a phenomenal response to that piece of work, and we continue to do it with our members and we'll hopefully be repeating that piece of research at the end of this year. Just very quickly, because I know we'll come onto this in the conversation, but I wrote a piece a couple of years ago actually about when this announcement came out about the egg freezing policy in sort of big tech organisations. And it's sort of an oddly tech solution to a problem that doesn't really require a tech skill set to fix it, and we see that so often, I think, in the workplace. And again, back to that point that it is so easy for employers to just try to fix the women or fix the minority group that seems to be the problem. Just give them the tools to help them come navigate the game somehow, get them to the top, and then maybe they can help us change things. And actually, what we're not ever doing is saying, well, how do we level the playing field rather than just teach someone the sort of hints and tips to play on an unlevel one.
Thank you. That's very, very good. Thank you. It's very interesting because I think the other force for change is that men themselves don't want to carry on working in the kind of setup that predominate now. Professor Anne Phillips has done amazing work. I've
for I don't know, a couple of 20 years or so, is more?
More.
Really inspiring work. I've used her many her work many times, so I'm really thrilled to introduce her.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, so when I first heard about the Apple and Facebook benefits package to women workers, I must say I felt pretty cross about it. And one of the reasons I felt cross was that it seemed like a case of employers getting kudos for you know, seeming to recognise the problems of their women workers, bending over backwards to help them. But actually what they were saying, if you think about what's being said there, they're saying, we want you and we need you in your peak childbearing years. So just postpone the peak childbearing years. So there's no kind of sense that that they have a responsibility to address the problems that the current organisation of work actually throws up for people who also have a life and a sense that part of that life is going to involve children. It just sort of takes it for granted that those tensions between work and children or work and life have to be addressed by postponing the pregnancy. It seems to me it's not far off saying that, if women want a great career, they just shouldn't have children. I mean, it's better than that, clearly, because it's saying you can have children as long as you give us your best years first and then postpone it and have the children later. But it's kind of similar. So it's a framework in which all the burden of change is on the women. It's not on the men, and it's not on what seems to me the kind of the grotesque ways in which we currently organise work. I think one of the examples that has recently struck me as kind of relevant to this is that there's research on members of Parliament in Westminster Parliament and who has children. And basically, about three quarters of male MPs have children, which sounds a bit less than the average, but it's in line with the average. But less than half of women MPs have children. And if you think about what that's saying, basically it's saying that for men, if you want a political career, you can have a political career and you can be a father. Whereas for women, you may have to choose between having a political career and being a mother, right? And I mean, that's the kind of, it seems to me the acceptance of that is in a sense just reinforced by egg freezing as a solution to the problems of work. I think the part of the problem, I think, does lie with men, right? Part of the problem lies with the fact that the responsibility for children, which, one can, in a sense, deal more easily with the sort of time taken off work in relation to pregnancy and immediately after pregnancy. But, the reason that people feel that there's this conflict between children and work is the kind of, in a sense, the impact of children in a longer-term sense over the kind of the months and the years. Some of the problem lies with men still not taking a sense of equal share for that. But much of the problem lies with the kind of long hours culture that has become so endemic in our society. And if you think of the absurdity of what we have at the moment, we have people on 0 hours on contracts, a huge amount of underemployment and unemployment, people who don't know from one day to the next whether they're working, what shift they're working, just a terrible kind of context in which to try to organise having children. And then at the other side, you have people who are trying to develop a career in which all of the kind of the prospects of promotion and development depend on you working far longer than the 35 hours that is, if anyone actually ever reads the contract, usually is there somewhere in the contractual norm. Now, my ideal for a solution is, of course, very utopian, which is, a world in which everyone works maximum 20-hour week, men and women alike. It's not so dark. And the work just has to organise itself around that. I think there's a presumption. I think actually, and quite a lot of the studies of work demonstrate that the kind of the final hours that we put in at the end of the day don't actually add a great deal to what we've managed to do earlier on. I mean, there's a limit to how creative and productive and amazing and brilliant you can be if you're actually working a 10-hour day. So that's my ideal. But of course, short of that, there's a huge amount of good practice to build on. It just isn't being used. There are obvious things to do with with maternity and paternity leave, job shares, flexible hours, a real right to take periods out of work with a guarantee that you go back to the same level. I mean, so many people take time off work and they go back to a job which has less responsibility and they're really set back in their career. I work in a university, which in many ways is quite a favourable context in which to have children, because it's kind of, you know, a lot of the work is flexible hours. There's pretty good both maternity and paternity leave, usually. You have term times and holidays. So, you know, many ways it's very good, but it's the same kind of career pressure, which is that in your 30s, likely to be the time that you're having children, that's the point at which you've got to be researching, you've got to be publishing, you've got to be getting ahead, and that's the point at which either those without children or the men who have children but don't have the same full-time responsibility for them, they're the ones that get ahead. I mean, one of the things that my own university has recently done, which is a small gesture in this direction, is that anyone who takes a period of maternity or indeed paternity leave is then entitled to a term of research leave to kind of kickstart the sort of the research and writing side of the job. You can cope with the teaching side of the job. You can fit that in. It's the extra creativity of the writing that's more difficult. But it's a small part. But I mean, there are lots of things that can be done, and it's not I think evident that employers can't accommodate that. And if it's a problem for them, it's a problem that, as you say, they just need to take on, because this has to be the world that we kind of move towards, one in which men and women alike are able to work equally. It's not something that should be solved by requiring individual women to make these very painful and difficult choices about at what point in their lives they're able to focus on the career and at what point in their lives they're able to think about having children. It shouldn't be something that the individual does. It should be something that we have a structural solution for.
Thanks, Anne. I think the other side of that too is that from a collective point of view, I think the commercialisation of motherhood is quite shocking, where women are being encouraged to rent their wombs out. And in America, they actually call a woman who's a surrogate an alternative reproductive vehicle. And you can see this happening more and more and more. So, and because of all the pressures that Anne was talking about, they're also remodeling what motherhood is. So it's sort of like you're a part-time appearance person in your child's life. So it doesn't just stop, as I said earlier.
Yes,
you know, when you're a teenager, when you've got teenagers, they can sometimes need you and in more unpredictable ways. And they certainly don't want to go to nursery for a start. You can't get them to go to an after school club. So, you know, I think there's an undervaluing of that relationship that parents have with their children that actually also relates to how good you can be in the job that you do.
Yes.
So there's lots that are not, that all have to be part of the debate. And I'm really, really pleased that that Ada's list has started, because that's a whole area where you really do need pioneers. I mean, if this is what we're talking about, is tough. It's even tougher in the tech world, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm Nikki. I'm one of the co-founders of Ada's List, and I'm also business director at Us2, which is a digital product studio. So I do work and have worked for a while in the tech industry. Before I came this evening, I noticed a column where someone said that now 1 in 4 women in their 40s are now without children. I found that statistic quite shocking and kind of amazing at the same time. And obviously some of those women have made that decision. That was a proactive choice, and I absolutely, and as I'm sure the other women on the panel do, totally support that. But other women in that situation have found themselves in that situation because they put their careers first, and by the time they were thinking about kids it was too late, or perhaps they haven't made the right person. And so for me that sort of really raises to the front of my mind that fertility is actually not just a woman's issue, it's a society's issue, because we're talking about the workforce of the future from a kind of corporation's perspective, but also from a community's perspective, we're talking about kind of future people we want to spend time with, our future generation. And so when I thought about this evening, I thought a little bit about the fact that we don't talk about fertility enough, actually, as a kind of as women. It's not something that society really wants to engage with or talk about. It's sort of embarrassing or awkward to be talking about it. And I think I only was very aware of it because I had an autoimmune disease called Graves' disease, which meant that in my 20s, I spent a lot of time in consultants' offices being told that my fertility was going to be affected. And when they removed my thyroid, that I had to have a treatment, which was surgical surgery, rather than radioactive iodine, which is the standard treatment for Graves' disease, which could have affected my fertility. And so I spent a lot of my 20s thinking, when am I going to have a child? What am I going to do about having a child? And my first boss was this very impressive editor of a national newspaper. She'd been editor of national magazines. And a few months into working for her, she said to me very clearly, I have had the most incredible career, I've done brilliant things, and she has, she's still doing fantastic things, but I only have one child because I, only at 40, and she'd been with the right man for a long time, realised that I wanted to have a child because I was invested in my career. And that was a very stark message for me early on in my career, as well as these fertility issues that I thought I had. But I realised it was something that I wanted to do sooner rather than others. And so the average age currently to have a child is allegedly 33.1 years of age. And I had a child at 32, and that seems young compared to my peers who weren't having children and still, in fact, my good friends from university haven't had children. I'm now almost 35 for context. And so I think that's a very personal lens on it. But what I learned during that journey is incredibly difficult to return to work. It is very difficult to be working in the tech industry, having a child. I was telling the other panel members just before we started that, you know, there are lots of embarrassing things about returning to work early. When you're a mother, you're tearful, you're hormonal, you have to get your breast pump out in an open plan office, they're very loud. So lots of things that just sort of minutiae that feel challenging. But also I returned at when my baby was 5.5 months old because I was worried about my job being taken away from me. Because legally, after 26 weeks, your employers are entitled to, whilst they have to retain your job, they're entitled to actually change the specifics of it, as long as it's sort of similar to the role you currently have. And so lots of women, in fact, I read this morning that 4 in 10 women are actually returning to off maternity leave sooner than they want to. And that's shocking. 47% of women are, according to the National Childbirth Trust, really, really concerned about the viability of their job and the maternity leave. That's not what you should be thinking about. You should be bonding with your baby, having a really great time. It's an amazing experience. So for me, it's about, we don't make life easy for women, or parents generally, actually. We make it a constant tension, choosing between career and childhood, and you shouldn't have to. Family is an important part of life, and being able to make that decision is something we should all be entitled to. And so I think I'm really interested to hear from the audience as well, but you know, we owe it to women and we owe it to ourselves to be finding better solutions, and there are pragmatic solutions that employers can just start doing straight away. I'm not quite as radical as Anne here, because I work a much longer week than Anne envisages as being ideal, but you know, we can do simple things. Stop prioritising presenteeism over contribution. You know, it's okay to still be contributing in the workplace even if you're not there. Mm-hmm. It's okay to leave early because you're going to get back online later and do what you said you were going to do. Stop calling parents and people who work flexible hours part-time workers. It's so insulting. These people are still contributing, still putting the mileage in, still actually making a difference to the work you're doing. We should be building transparent learning cultures so that when people take time out for whatever reason, actually whether they're going to have a baby or they just need a damn break, so that you can return to work and we can all talk about it, and that's okay. It shouldn't be this, I mean obviously competition is natural, but these very competitive environments where we look down on people who return from work and don't treat them like normal human beings. We should stop passing over women who've taken time out. It's not a holiday going to have a baby. But I have been witness to conversations where people have said, you've had a year off, we can't consider you for a promotion. She didn't go to India or somewhere else. You know, and male bosses, this is the first time I've mentioned men, should really recognise their biases here. There is an ingrained unconscious bias here that actually women are passed over for salary increases or promotions when they've taken time out to have a baby, and that's not okay. They are still highly intelligent, functioning human beings who are making a contribution. And while they were having baby, I'm sure they were thinking about what they want to be doing when they come back.
I don't think it's always that unconscious.
No, true. very, very true. And there's a small thing that's a very simple thing, which is just respect people's diaries. I say that's a baseline, actually. That's not something we'll do tomorrow. Respect people's calendars and understand that, you know, with the word flexible working comes an understanding that actually it's okay to be doing other things at different times within the working hours. So, as for what, you know, as for the specifics of egg breeding, I'm all for choice, but I personally wouldn't invest in a vet that only has a 6 to 12% chance of fruition. And so I think, yes, it's great that Apple and Google are saying, here, this is part of your health benefits, but not if that's why you're incentivizing me to work longer hours and still having a baby for another 10 years.
Oh, great, lovely. That's a cracking start. Just because I know we've got four men here, and I think if men don't join us, and if men don't join this imminent revolution, which I can feel coming on here, they're going to be stuffed. One of the pieces of research shows that the men who feel most stressed are men working part-time to have more time with their children, which says quite a lot about how women must feel doing the same thing. But that's because they feel torn in every which way. And I went to Norway for The Guardian because they have a 40% quota system on boards. And I was talking to the Minister for Employment, who was a man, who at 4 o'clock said, well, I'm sorry, I have to go and pick up my children. And there was this mass exodus from the government buildings, and everybody thought that was perfectly okay. And Norway hasn't crunched to a halt. I mean, things still get done. So cultural change, when it happens, can happen really, really quickly. So I think, I'm sure we've got collective wisdom in this room to get this thing going. Or maybe even if somebody wants to stand up and advocate egg freezing, that's absolutely fine too. we'll see how many people are going to be brave enough to ask questions or make comments. And if there's a few, we'll take two at a time. If there's only one, we'll busk it. So who'd like to start? Or should I just pick on somebody? Oh, great. OK, that's a good idea, yes. Can you say what your names are and then fire ahead.
I'm Chloe. So I thought it was really interesting what you said about that kind of teenage shift. My mum was a teacher, decided that when we were little, it didn't actually matter that much whether she was the one picking us up because we wouldn't know. Yeah. And when we were teenagers, she made sure that she was home when we got home every day. And I think that's really progressive, but not something that a lot of women maybe even think about. What do you think we can do to kind of shift that perception, or structurally what would need to happen so that that idea of just because you're a teenager and can get home by yourself doesn't mean you don't need a caregiver around.
Hi, I'm Ursula. I run a business called Makeversity, which is set up by four male founders. And I guess one of the things I'm interested in is ways of, you know, helping men understand those conscious or unconscious biases in a non kind of confrontational way, because I think that's a really important thing to be able to do.
Very good. So should we start with Catherine and work this way? So it's teenagers and shifting the focus a bit so people understand that they still need support, and how do you get men in a non-confrontational way to wrap their arms around this idea and rock the baby?
So two small things. Mm-hmm. So I think Nikki hit the nail on the head with the first question, which is around about how we structure work, which is that we're so focused on presenteeism in most industries, actually, and the idea that you have to be seen at your desk to be working, and we're so focused on hours worked rather than what we produce at the end of it. And so if we can move all organisations to more outputs-focused work, how somebody structures their work then is their own business. And I think as soon as we can start to free things up for people to just, you know, to manage their own time more effectively, we will see a radical shift both for men and women in terms of their roles in caregiving. You know, that it's not just about children, it's not just about teenagers, it's also about older parents now. We're seeing that crunch, you know, for a lot of women who, you know, sooner if they finish looking after their children, they're now expected to look after older relatives. And so I think as soon as we can, you know, if I think about my own organisation as an example, we are brilliant at flexible working, and we trust that people are, one of my employees is in the audience, she can maybe tell me otherwise, but I think I'm pretty good at this, which is that, you know, we trust each other to get on with our workload. And, you know, I don't mind where my team is working from. I don't really mind what hours they work as long as they suit them, but I'm more interested in what they produce at the end of that rather than how they've done it. And it's amazing what kind of trust that actually engenders in your employees, actually the sort of loyalty that you generate for your organisation as well. So I think that's the first thing. Second question, how do we engage men? So on the bias piece, a lot of organisations are throwing money at unconscious bias training, and there are a lot of people very successfully making a lot of money out of doing that, maybe I'm in the wrong industry. That plays its part, certainly, and I actually underwent unconscious bias training again the other day after a couple of years of not doing it. It's always interesting to kind of challenge your own preconceptions and your own biases, and that's, if you can find a good provider, that's often a really good way of kind of getting men and women into a shared conversation about those things. I think the other thing is kind of, I suppose you have to find a way of positioning it, because ultimately people don't like being told that they're wrong. They don't like being told that they have privilege and sort of having that power challenged in an overtly aggressive way. And so we have to find ways of engaging men in the conversation that gets them to feel some kind of empathy. And often when you're talking about exclusion, you know, everybody has a story of when they weren't a part of something. Everybody has has had an experience where they felt isolated and not part of something. And actually, interestingly, one of the things you can play on with men, not that this doesn't work for all men, but there's something about the daughter effect that seems to play a really big part in a lot of men in work. And there's a really interesting piece of research a couple of years ago from the States that looked at the fact that typically employee pay went up when CEOs had daughters. Which I thought was a really nice stat, in the fact that suddenly a guy goes, oh my god, my little girl's going to have a terrible time in the world. Right, let's make it better for women everywhere. which, you know, actually is something else that you can play on. But I think finding that kind of emotional connection, and sometimes it's slow conversations, it's slowly, slowly building up, and finding your kind of individual change agents almost across the organisation.
Okay, well, the teenagers one really hits home to me, because with my own children, that's when I made my biggest mistakes. I mean, I kind of thought, you know, once you've got those early years out of the system, everything's fine. And I have this abiding image of myself in the years when my children were teenagers, of me sitting at my computer, and they're kind of, the door opens in my study, and I look around and say, yes? And, and I kind of think, why didn't I kind of just give a bit more time in that period? You make many mistakes as a parent, but those are the ones that I most remember. But I think the answer to that is the kind of flexibility that you're talking about, because you actually do have more hours in the day when your children are teenagers. You sleep at night, mostly, if they don't come home too late. But it's kind of having the capacity for yourself, but also for your employer, to be able to kind of see that you can move your work around the spaces that are necessary for sort of dropping things because there's a crisis on with your son or daughter. So yeah, I think it's very, very much the point. The thing about male bias, it strikes me that we're at a kind of slightly difficult sort of halfway point at the moment, because it's very clear, one knows it, from the men but also from studies, that men want to spend more time with children, right? I mean, that it's something that comes through in a lot of surveys, and that mostly men are spending more time, those men who have children are spending more time with them, mostly. But my sense is that, in a way, just for the moment, that kind of reinforces a sense that you can solve this on an individual basis, because they're not actually having to take on really half shares of the work. They are managing both to spend more time with their children, be better parents, and get on with that career. And so why can't the women do that? Mm-hmm. And I think that actually continues to feed into the bias of those men who are in positions of deciding who gets promotion, who gets the extra kind of salary increment and so on. Because they feel that they themselves have managed to do this through making sure that they do both. But they haven't really yet grasped the sense in which that's very difficult if you're the one who ultimately is still carrying the kind of the primary responsibility. So I think it's one of those cases where there's been a shift, but it's kind of one of those shifts that almost, if it just goes halfway, for a certain period, it almost makes things worse for a time. Yeah, so that's not a solution to your question, but just a sort of thought about the stage that we're at with moving that issue.
Mickey.
On teenagers, how terrifying, that's all ahead of me. I'm only 2.5 years into the parenting journey and I'm sure I've made lots of mistakes already. I do think a lot of it does tie to flexible working. I think it's really important that employers recognise that. Actually, the public sector, who I don't normally credit with loads of innovation in this area, in many areas, but in this particular area, certainly when I worked for the NHS, I remember being really impressed with the way they talked about flexible working, to the extent that even your lunchtime was flexible. So that meant I used to go kind of running the hills around Edinburgh. But that was a fantastic model where people could come in as late as 10 and did leave as early as 4. What happens where I currently work, so in the tech industry, is we actually do employ a flexible co-working hour as well. So I'm quite confident to leave the office at 4 and get back online at 8. It does assume a 60-hour week rather than 20-hour week. But you know, there are ways to work around that, and I just think we have to talk about that more. And again, it's not an individual action. You actually have to force companies, probably government long term, to legislate to ensure that kind of flexibility is a right for everyone. So it's about the right to do that. And on unconscious bias, I think that's really tricky. As Catherine says, it's brilliant that lots and lots more organisations are doing this training. Where I work is about to do that training in a couple of weeks. And it's really interesting because lots of people think that they're not biased and then they realise they really are and they talk about it and that's great. But actually, for me, a lot of it is about encouraging the conversation regularly, all the time. I talk about, to every single man I know, I talk about it all the time and I'm really annoying about it and they know. And but the thing is, you've got to move the needle even a little bit, as much as you can. For another reason, I was speaking to Marthalene Fox this morning, and obviously she is pioneering lots of conversation about getting more women into technology and changing the ratio to a 50-50 space within technology. And I think she's aware that there are more and more articles where we're talking about women in work, and so there does feel like there's beginning to be a little bit of momentum behind the conversation. So I just think keep talking about it. I mean, you're not going to change anything in a day, but definitely keep making noise about it.
I think talking about it is very important, but I think there is a conspiracy of silence that I was on a panel with the National Grid, and to my amazement, they have something like 50 different patterns of working. So they're varying a huge number of patterns of working. So it's become the norm. So men do it as well. And as you were saying, the important thing is that the job gets done, not where or not at what time or whatever. But even there, after this event, a woman came up to me in her 40s in a very senior position in tears because she was pregnant with her third baby and she knew this was crunch time that she would not be able to do. And I asked her, why don't you actually talk about this to the people who employ you? And she said, I couldn't possibly, it would affect my... So, you know, there's an assumption on the part of women. I think there's two things. One, women assume it will go badly for them, even those women, and there are many more now in senior positions who are willing to be part of the chain. But I think the other thing is women have a big thing about control, partly because we've had to. So even when you are at home, working full-time like your partner, with two kids, he can't do things properly, so you do them. So well, that's my problem. I'm talking personally now. That is my problem. So I've now stopped checking, the supermarket list, because where does that get you, really? It just aggravates you, because everything's 3 times the size that you expected. Not always. But, I do think we have to be more honest about what, and I don't mean in a terrible Sheryl Sandberg way about leaning in, because that is such rubbish.
Yeah, that's
but I do mean about what we have to let go of, I suppose.
Yes.
One is our silence. So, any more questions, please? We've still got lots of time, and there's a terrific panel here. Yep. Gentleman at the back.
Hi, thanks very much. So it's an observation and a question. So observation, firstly, was that I really liked what you were saying about talking about all the time. We've just found, I work in a very male-oriented industry, and we've found recently that just the few guys that I work with, just by talking about going home to see our kids, dropping kids off at school, leaving early to go and take kids to swimming, that has a sort of role, circular effect that encourages other people to also say the same thing, and then more and more and more. Mm-hmm. And then gradually we find that people are coming into work at 9:30 and 10 and leaving work at 5, and it just becomes natural. And that's in an industry where, it's probably one of my clients is the most male-dominated industry I've ever seen, and it's already happening in there. So that was one observation. The question that I had, because I'm really interested to know practically what we can do differently, what we as in men can do differently. question is, to what extent, and I guess this is like a positive discrimination question, so to what extent should we be pushing the boundaries? So, for example, in fact, just today, the guy I was talking with said, you know, next year, should we just do a tranche of just promoting women in our team? Or should we have a mentoring of women in our team? Or should we target our team leads that they have to get a certain number of women promoted? Not a quota, but a target. Or should it just be, like you were saying, you know, being more aware of the unconscious bias? So I'm just trying to get a feel from the panel, I guess, to what extent you think we should be proactive and, if the word's positive discrimination, then that's fine.
And what's your name?
Sam.
Sam. Okay, thanks. And there was somebody else at the back there. Yeah. So, yeah.
My name is Chloe. I was just wondering, if we go back to the topic of egg freezing, what kind of message does that...
Yes, we're alive.
I was just wondering, what kind of message does that send to future employees, you know? Is it? Would you like to work for a company that offers egg freezing? You know, it does mean the later, the better. If you get your children as late as possible, then we will welcome you. And I think it's a massive mistake from Apple and Google to have done that. So I wanted to know your views on this.
Okay. Should we go the other way this time?
Yeah.
So, Nikki, advice for Sam on how to go about it, and Chloe, egg freezing, what does it say about future employees?
So I think the first question I'd ask, because I'm a big fan of quotas and positive discrimination, even though I know that rubs some people up the wrong way, but why aren't those women being promoted in the first place? And I think that is slightly ties into the whole unconscious bias piece. You know, what is it about the way that they behave in a certain meeting that might be deemed, that might be assertiveness, but some people mark down as she's a bit aggressive. You know, what is it about the way they're behaving, the work they've been doing, that actually has meant that they haven't even been considered for promotion already? I'm making an assumption here that the most of the senior people in the team are actually male. So I think that would certainly be something I'd want to at least have a conversation about. And then, yeah, I think it's a great idea to be having conversations about how could we mentor women. If you have a full mentoring program, obviously you don't necessarily want to do something specialist for women. You might want to make sure, is there something we're equally doing for everyone that ensures that everyone from junior to midweight is moving through progression and that we're actually supporting individuals' development. Mentoring programs can make a real difference for lots of individuals, regardless of gender. So, yeah, I'd question why it hasn't happened and then look at ways to remedy. I think it's a great question. So on egg freezing, I think that's a really, really fair assumption to make. I questioned a couple of people at work, so I was interested in females' opinions before I came there. And some of them were quite positive. They were like, I quite like the idea of the fact that I've been working so hard, I haven't had time to meet someone. And I quite like the idea that my company is going to kind of enable me not to worry about that problem, but I'd have to have real trust in the leadership team and I'd have to be really certain that it wasn't for macabre reasons. I think there are some progressive policies out there that work really well for certain organisations where they enable people to determine how much leave they're going to take. Don't know how well that works out. Sometimes they take none. And I think I sort of put the egg freezing policy in that same category. It might work out well for some people, but I still question whether the net effect is actually good for everybody. So, I agree with you. It could be off-putting. For other people, though, they could read it in the same way that they read health insurance, pension plan, a mobile allowance and everything else. It's just like, brilliant, tick. That's another thing. So I guess for others it will be an incentive.
I think Timeless did a poll. I don't know, Sarah. Yeah, they did a poll, and 84% of young women, thought it was a positive thing to do for their career development, which is really alarming.
So like Nikki, I mean, I also think targets and quotas are a very good way of focusing the mind on the reasons why certain kinds of people have been favoured over others, and what kind of bias may be going into that process. So again, just to take an example from where I work, the department that has been least successful in recruiting women, perhaps not surprisingly, is the economics department in the university where I am. And they've recently adopted a target of, to aim for at least 50% women on the shortlists for every new post that they appoint, which I was kind of stunned that it was the economics department that came up with that. It went against all of my prejudices of that. So, and I don't know how it's going to work out, it seems to me that's a really kind of positive step forward. That's not saying that they have to appoint a woman, but it's kind of making it much more likely that they're going to take very seriously the CVs of the women who apply for the posts. And then, yes, in terms of what does it say about the companies, I mean, it's very hard to me not to read a commitment to finance egg freezing as a kind of commitment to finance egg freezing instead of all the other changes that are probably more costly that an employer could make, which would actually make it possible for you to both have a career, an exciting, brilliant career, and have children at the same time. I mean, it is possible to do that, and there are people who do that, but the company needs to put quite a lot of resources behind those changes, and it seems to me that it just reeks of egg freezing as the kind of, in a sense, the cheaper option rather than addressing the more expensive one. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I'm right. I mean, I think one of the things that Sarah said to me at one point about the egg freezing was that a lot of the young women who said they were interested in it, in a sense, it wasn't necessarily that they were thinking about their career prospects, but thinking, actually, I haven't yet found somebody that I could imagine having children with, and getting increasingly worried, as your 30s are ticking away, that moment hasn't come. And I have to say, I have more sympathy with that. I mean, the egg freezing is a very untried technique, and it's probably not a good idea for that reason anyway. But I have a bit more sympathy with that as a kind of, it's a kind of worry. It's when it becomes built into what companies are producing as their plan to solve the work-life balance problem, that's when it really gets to me.
I think the other thing is that egg freezing is hugely invasive. You have to. Yeah. It's really horrible. You inject yourself. Your hormones are upside down. Sometimes you have a reaction.
Yeah, sure.
It's like IVF. It's not easy.
Not
so I don't know if companies are prepared for all the days off that some women will need
yes,
to take.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And the other thing, it's really interesting. I was on a panel with headhunters looking exactly at some of the issues that Sam raised, and what they found is that lots and lots of women now get on long lists. But they don't get on the shortlists.
Yes.
So it's good for
the
economic department that they're actually putting them through to the shortlist. So, Catherine.
So, not much debate going on the panel here. I broadly agree with everything my colleagues have said on the panel. So just to answer your point about kind of getting more women through, it's actually really refreshing to be on a panel that is pro-quotas, because in the corporate world, everybody's still a bit boo-hiss quotas, and a lot of women want to believe that they're being selected because they're the best for the jobs. And, quite frankly, in most cases, they probably are. Mm-hmm. And I highly doubt that most of the people in power, whether it be our politicians or our business people today, were necessarily the best people for the job, quite frankly. I think there's a saying that when we have as many mediocre women running businesses as we do mediocre men, then we've achieved true equality. So my interest is in not in fixing the people, but it's about fixing the system. So I tense up when it automatically goes to mentoring programs, because actually I think Nikki's point is great. Mentoring's useful and helpful in your career, but it is for everybody, and women don't necessarily value that more than men. Sponsorship tends to work differently, i.e. the people kind of making decisions about your career behind closed doors where you're not actually a part of that conversation. That's a different thing. So again, challenging men on their sort of preconceptions and biases about who they're putting forward for those roles. So I'm a big fan of bias-proofing systems rather than bias-proofing people. It kind of ties back into that earlier question about unconscious bias, because you can put people through as much training as you like. Once they leave that room, what do they then go and do with that? Well, okay, I have a heightened awareness of my own biases, but actually I really like that guy I interviewed again. So actually, how do you bias-proof a process so that it doesn't allow that degree of subjectivity to come into it, whether it's about promotion, whether it's about pay rise, whatever the process is. And on egg freezing, I don't know if this is fair, Chloe and I work together, so to be fair, this is the conversation we'd be having down the pub anyway. And another thing. But my view on it is, yes, I'm absolutely all for women having choice. This feels oddly dystopian to me. I start to get very nervous when a corporate has any kind of influence over the choices that people make, the biological choices that people make. And I think for me, you know, it's the way they put it out there. To be fair, I think the media sort of took it and ran with it and said, this is what they're doing to make, you know, to keep women in work. It is in there as a sort of suite of health offerings in these sort of amazing American insurance packages. But they do consider it as part of a package to attract women into that industry. And that's where I get really concerned, because it sends out a message that your biology is not compatible with a career in this organisation. And so it's sort of positioned as a choice, but actually I see it as a false choice. I think it's a real stranglehold. And once they've got you, you know, it opens up lots of questions then about the kind of influence they can have over you. You know, what if your manager knew that you'd chosen to go down that route? And so they then have the power to say, well, okay, you've got your eggs on ice, so do you really want to do that now, or could you maybe just stay another year until you're ready for this promotion? So it sort of influences more kind of subjectivity and more bias into that process from other people who could have quite frightening power over somebody's choices.
Do you defrost the eggs? What do you do with them?
I'm in microwave.
I don't know. So we've got time for another couple of questions here, and any more, and that person there. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Fran. I'm interested, when we talk about targets, we talk, for understandable reasons, a lot about targets around women and all the effort on how we can help women, which is obviously makes abundant sense. But what about if we're trying to change a power balance that's currently weighted in favour of men, and we're trying to encourage certain amounts of behaviour change in men as well to change working cultures? What do you think about the idea of targets, for example, around getting men to take paternity leave or shared parental leave and that kind of, or part-time work and that kind of stuff? Because I haven't heard many examples of companies that actually do that kind of thing.
So use it or lose it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the person there?
Hi, my name is Claire. I'm 33. I work in the design industry. The creative industry, so I work extremely long hours. I don't see myself having children in the next 4 or 5 years, and I do want to focus on my career. However, I am aware that from coming in here yesterday and seeing this lovely display that actually my biological clock is ticking, and it's something that, you know, I do need to be aware of. And I feel that, you know, if I have the option to freeze my eggs and, you know, come the age of 40, if I do have that option, then yeah, that's certainly something I will consider, because at this moment in time in my life I want to focus on my career. However, I don't have the option now to go and have kids, because I don't want to. But I think it's something that we can't, you know, we are against the biological clock. There's nothing that we can't run away from that. So it is an issue that actually, it does give you choice, just like contraceptive give us choice, where we have, give us sexual freedom as women. So being able to freeze your eggs, I feel actually that does give you choice. And if you want to work in your career and do that, then that is also giving you the choice and ability to do that.
So, Catherine, more levers to get more men aware of their families in various ways, and egg freezing as a valid choice.
Yes, first question, totally in favour of that. I think, especially with things like shared parental leave, we desperately need to increase the number of men taking advantage of that. And the problem is the way the system's designed currently, it doesn't incentivise enough men to take equal share of parental leave. And so, you know, some progressive employers do, organisations like Accenture, EY, have equalised their maternity and paternity packages, which is a great thing, but those examples are so few and far between. I also think we always tend to couch quotas as this thing for women. I get it's about to sort of fix the women, but, you know, let's set a quota for women, a target for women. Why don't we set quotas and targets for men? Why don't we say no more than 50% men on board? You know, why, you know, we talk about genders in equal measure rather than it always being about the women? Because again, I think the optics of gender balance will help us get to a point where we start being more gender balanced in our approach. I've completely blanked on the
eggs. Eggs is a valid choice.
Totally your choice. You know, I think a totally personal choice, and I think if that feels right to you, then absolutely. I think you know, my earlier comments were sort of about the sort of risks of a corporation being able to influence that choice. That's where I find it deeply concerning. I think as long as you're fully informed of what lies ahead. So, you know, I had a similar thing. I walked in here and looked at that and thought, well, it's probably me done. But you know, as long as you have all of the information, understand that it is a big risk, and actually the chances of conceiving through that method are pretty slim to none. You know, be prepared to think about other options as well. You know, this is something that I and all of my friends are going through at the moment, and you know, there are other alternatives, whether that is, you know, adoption or whatever. You know, there are so many different options there that are brilliant and valid in life. So yeah, absolutely, don't feel like you should have a child now just because everyone's telling you you need to crack on with it. I think as long as we're all fully informed and genuinely making that choice about our life,
I think there's also an element here again about the rights of the child, because I mean, I had my second child at 46, and I didn't do any. I mean, I just had it. I mean, obviously, I did something. So I thought I had a bad case of flu, and obviously, I didn't. And I'm touch wood fairly healthy and stuff. But it does, you know, chronologically, you are not meant to have your children in your 40s, because my young, I've got a 31 and a 21 year old. I don't want my 21 year old to be visiting me in the care home when she's a 32 or something. I mean, not that would, you know, there are scenarios that we really need to choice, but choice drives us all mad. Sometimes we have no choice because the choice imposes on others in a way that maybe isn't fair. So I don't know, Anne.
Yes, yeah, no, I mean, just to continue on with that thought, that I think there is a way in which, in a way we've come to think that we have to make these choices and decisions about so many things. I kind of thought, when I didn't know whether I wanted to have children, I just thought, I just wish they hadn't invented contraception. Because now you have to make a choice. You know, actually, of course, they've had contraception for many, many years and just got more reliable. But I think there is a sense in which this wonderful display is somewhat misleading, as proven by Yvonne's case. Because it is true, your fertility drops incredibly. But really what that means is that your chances of getting pregnant when you're 20 are kind of like, you know, just sex and you're pregnant. Do use contraceptives when you're 20, you don't want to get pregnant. But, you know, women get pregnant, you know, all the way through their 30s and into their 40s, you know, so there is also the kind of the terrible panic that is created by the, you know, the way in which this is presented. Which then is used, of course, by people who are selling you various kinds of things. It's kind of, it's all sort of related to that. So I think there is, clearly there is a very severe decline in fertility, but, you know, it's quite a relief not to be at the top fertility level, because that's kind of, you know, that's very, that gives you very little control over your life. And then in terms of paternity leave, yes, it's... I think a lot of the problem, I mean, so employers can and should offer increasingly good packages for both fathers and mothers. Of course, not all women are having children with fathers who are going to actually be present through the whole process. I think quite a lot of it is to do with that thing about men talking, because I think men are... Even men I know who have access to quite good possibilities and conditions, they feel quite exposed still in taking advantage of these. They feel much more vulnerable to criticism from their fellow workers. So that ways in which it's recognised that women take leave when there are children around, but is still seen as rather kind of problematic for the men. So there's a lot of work to be done in relation to that as well, I think, to just normalise it for a man. I think men would like to have that opportunity, but they're still made to feel that they are failing their fellow workers, failing the company, in a way that, with all the pressures, that's not the particular pressure that's on women. The thing is, you lose your career, you know, rather than...
No, I agree. I mean, I think consistently, whether a man or a woman asks me who looks after my daughter, and I say she's in nursery, and then I spend a day with her, and my partner spends a day with her, and they go, "Oh, wow, your husband spends a day of his 5-day working week at home with his child." And I'm personally very lucky because we always agreed we were going to co-parent, and he definitely does a lot of the dishes and the washing up and all those things, so because I'm terrible at them. So we're quite good on the equality front, both domestically and in terms of sharing co-parenting. But I think removing that stigma is a struggle. I work somewhere, they have 3 months paid paternity leave. Most of the men take it, but it's still seen as slightly odd. And in companies where they're being really radical and fantastic, where they've completely equalised paternity and maternity leaves, they call it parental leave, and it's 6 months for everyone in a good company, fully paid. Not many men take it. And so until we're able to talk about that and say it's completely acceptable for men and women, and we start using the language of parental leave and co-parenting in a much more open forum, I think it's going to be quite difficult to actually impact a change. So I think, just got, again, back to my earlier point, talk about it more. And on egg freezing, I mean, it's a valid choice. I think what I personally resent is the fact that it seems like it's a choice between a career and having children. You can have a really good career and have children, and it's also about sort of acknowledging that there are ways to work around that. I remember being absolutely shocked to the core when a graphic design friend of mine had twins at 26. That felt really, really radical. I didn't know anyone who was having kids. I remember thinking, my God, she's going to take so much time out, and twins are really insane and taxing on your time and brilliant. And she is now far ahead of many of her peers who didn't have kids, because she's just got back on with it. You know, she's had a brilliant time with them for the first few years of their life, and she's now created her career around school, and she's kind of not that bothered. And so I think it's having the freedom to be able to talk about, actually, your career isn't over when you have a child, and you have to feel confident about having that conversation with your employers, and sort of feel it's difficult, but that doesn't mean that you can't make that choice.
Can I just add a final small insight from some of the work that we've done, which is, I think it's been really interesting. This is sort of very small scale, but I think it's been really interesting to see what the increased visibility of same-sex parents do for shifting this debate as well. Mm-hmm. This discussion tends to be very heteronormative, and actually we've done some research off the back of Project 2840 with lesbian, gay women, bisexual women, queer women. And what was really interesting was when you compared them to their straight counterparts, they were far less likely to be nervous about the impact of having a family on their careers.
Because they're co-parenting.
They are genuinely co-parenting. And so as women, you know, they don't inherit these societal, you know, two women living together, they don't inherit these societal norms. You know, people don't have expectations of how they're going to do this. They're, you know, people are just sort of watching and waiting to see how the hell they do this. And by and large, because, you know, they are women, they tend to have these discussions a lot, and they talk about sharing things much more equally. And so gay women were much more likely to say, actually, my partner, I'm comfortable, my partner will be more supportive of me developing my career after having children. I'm less nervous about the impact of having children on my career. And, you know, employers are again kind of watching and waiting for women to sort of create this, and men to an extent as well, for them. And I think that's actually really nice, because it looks actually, if we just cut out all of the societal crap, look at what we can achieve. It can be more balanced, it can be much more equal.
Well, we have to come to a close there. It's one of the most imaginative ways of actually making people focus on some of the issues. So I think absolutely well done. Yeah. Thank you to the panel. Brilliant. Really, really interesting views, and so articulate. It heartens me that I'm a woman, basically.
Listen to all of our talks and find out more information at time-less.org.